As has been announced, the topic of today's discussion is Theosophy and Practical Charity. The word charity is defined in the dictionary as the voluntary giving of help, typically money, to those in need. Help or money given in this way, this is called as charity, defined as charity. One of the synonym of charity is also philanthropy, which comes from combination of two Greek words, phil, love, anthropy refers to the human race, so love of human beings. So regarding this voluntary giving of money for the betterment of human condition, we have various examples. Many institutions have been set up, many individuals, businessmen, billionaires who have donated billions of dollars for betterment of one or the other social or physical condition of mankind. For example, we have the Bill and the Melinda Gates Foundation. You can just check in their website there how they have dispersed grants in different thematic areas. Few of them are mentioned, which is noted down here. $1.5 billion to a United Negro College Fund, $1.5 billion, $1 billion to research regarding vaccines, $750 million to fight AIDS, TB and malaria. Various such projects are undertaken. In India also, one of the oldest philanthropic institutions is Sir Ratan Tata Trust, established in 1919. They work on health, rural livelihood, education, among other themes. And then there is Sir Durabji Tata Trust. And SRTT, Sir Ratan Tata Trust, disburses nearly $38 million every year. So huge amount of money is distributed and used in terms of grants, donations and so on in various fields. Now this word charity itself comes from an old French word which is probably pronounced as charité, charité, which in its turn is derived from the Latin word caritas, which means preciousness, dearness, high price. So this word has a Latin origin which means preciousness or dearness. And the idea of charity is not something new to the world. All ancient religions speak of it. So much so that many of the religions have charity, almsgiving, as a part of their traditional cultural systems. For example, one of the five pillars of Islam is zakat, which is almsgiving. And this word zakat, interestingly, means that which purifies, that which purifies. And the Puranas speak of various merits and rewards, worldly as well as otherworldly, which can be obtained by one who engages in different kinds of charity. And of course, in Buddhism also it is a strong idea of charity. And even in Christianity we find that. So it is present among all religions, among all traditions. But the question that has to be asked is, Does monetary help alone solve the problems which we find expressed in various human conditions? That is the question that has to be asked. Can money alone solve the problems which we find in the world today? No, one of the, you may say, a philanthropist who works in Rajasthan, who has worked for many decades among the rural livelihood of the population there, and who has worked on reviving the traditional water systems, he was asked about his views on poverty, and his answer was very interesting. He said that poverty has nothing to do with deficit of money or scarcity of money. Poverty is a mental attitude, he says. He says when the mind loses its power of self-reliance, then that man is poor. So an interesting idea that this person who has worked for many decades among the so-called poor of the rural Rajasthan population, his views on poverty is interesting. And further to that, if we examine the results of various projects that are undertaken by civil societies, NGOs, trusts, philanthropic organizations, through donations and the various government schemes, what do we find as a result of most of these projects? We find that either they do not succeed in solving the problems, or even if they succeed, they only partly succeed, and most of the times they tend to add a different level of complexity into that area where that project is undertaken. We will not go into the details of that, but if one studies this, he will see this very evidently. Now this is one aspect of it. The other important deeper aspect of this subject is, what is the motive behind charity? If we donate money, if we help somebody, what is the motive behind that? That is the most important idea. It is not the action itself, but the motive behind it, the intention behind it, that colors the action, makes it good or evil, makes it helpful or harmful. This has to be this is a very important point which must be noted. And how beautifully Krishna brings this in the 17th chapter of the Gita. I'll just read a small portion. Krishna says, I quote, "Those gifts which are bestowed at the proper time to the proper person and by men who are not desirous of a return are of the sattva quality, good, and of the nature of truth. But that gift which is given with the expectation of a return from the beneficiary or with a view of spiritual benefit flowing therefrom, or with a view of spiritual benefit flowing therefrom, or with reluctance, is of the rajas quality, bad, and partaketh of untruth. Gifts given out of place and season, and to unworthy people, and to unworthy persons, without proper attention and scornfully, are of the tamas quality, wholly bad, and of the nature of darkness." Unquote. So here we see Krishna clearly enumerating different kinds of motives or a mental attitude with which we do actions, give gifts, donations, and so on. How it colors those actions, very important. This is not true only with respect to charity or acts of kindness to others, but in all human actions. This is an important factor, our intention. or feeling, that is most important thing. So also Krishna says in the next chapter of the Gita 18 that acts of charity should not be abandoned, but they should be done without selfish interest, without selfish interest. And let's read a few motives enumerated in one of the Buddhist texts, Anguttara Nikaya, where Buddha enumerates 8 different motives with which people engage in charity. First is, one gives with annoyance or as a way of offending the recipient or with the idea of insulting him. Second, fear also can motivate a person to make an offering out of fear. Third, one gives in return for a favor done to oneself in the past, return of favor. Fourth, one may also give with the hope of getting a similar favor for oneself in the future. Fifth, one gives because giving is considered good. Sixth is one who thinks a bhikkhu comes with begging, and one who thinks, I cook, they do not cook. It is proper for me who cooks not to give to those who do not cook. Some give urged by such altruistic motives. Seventh, some give alms to gain a good reputation. And finally, others give alms to adorn and beautify the mind. Adorn and beautify the mind. So with all these different motives enumerated here in the Gita and the Buddhist text, let us keep this in front of us and examine all the charitable works that are done. Where do they stand? What is the moral character of each of these charitable acts? We cannot judge others, we cannot judge others' act, but when we are doing it, let us remember what is the motive which is impelling us to do this. And in the New Testament, Jesus is very clear when he says, I quote, be careful not to do your acts of righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven, unquote. So let's remember these few points about giving monetary help or financial help. Now, moving forward, let us, if we look at various problems which beset the world, problems of health, poverty, with no access to food, water, clean air, and then there are philanthropic organizations which work on education. Wherever you look, you will find one or the other kind of human problems. And added to this is natural disasters, like what happened in Haiti, which almost devastated the whole place. And then, as if this is not sufficient, there are wars and human exploitation and injustice which adds to the human problems. But how does the thinking mind of today, modern thinking mind, try to solve these problems? In one sentence, if we have to explain it, it is hypothesis upon hypothesis. There are civil societies which want to solve the problems for various reasons. Governments and other bodies, research organizations and academics, which want to solve these human problems. All of these engage with various fields of science. Anthropology is used by civil societies today. And then sociologists are hired, technologists, economists. Each branch is specialized, and each expert in that field tries to solve the problem with his own mindset, in his own narrow framework which he has drawn for himself. So it is like six blind men trying to grasp what an elephant is, and each one of them is not complete. They don't have that holistic view. So what we can understand from this is that there is no one holistic, all-comprehending philosophy, that theory of change which is used by these various organizations does not have a unifying, all-comprehending, holistic view. Everything is either hypothesis which changes after a few years, or it is very limited to only one small aspect of man. So let's recollect here what Krishna says in chapter 18, where he enumerates different kinds of wisdom or knowledge, and he says, I quote, "Know that the wisdom which perceives in all nature one single principle, indivisible and incorruptible, not separate in separate object seen, is of the sattva quality. The knowledge which perceives different and manifold principles as present in the world of created beings pertain to rajas, the quality of passion. But that knowledge, wholly without value, which is mean, attached to one object alone as if it were the whole, which does not see the true cause of existence, is of the nature of tamas, indifferent and dark," unquote. So very nice standard to see where our all modern hypothesis and theories stand. So what is needed by one who seriously wishes to engage in practical charity is a holistic view of life. Currently, what is the view of life? Let's examine this, and then let's compare it with what is the ancient view of life, or the view of life of the ancient philosophy. The modern view is man is just a body, just a neurological machine with some chemical and physical reactions that take place, and that's about it. Life is meaningless because it begins in the womb of the mother and it ends at the grave. From cradle to grave is whatever is there. So that's about it. So the primary focus is on the physical conditions, body and its conditions. That is the primary focus. And you see any aspect of science, whether it is a branch of the natural science or a branch of the social science, we find that primary focus today is on the physical. The basis is physical. And from this idea arises, what is the idea of progress? If man is only a physical being, progress is only his physical comforts, which can be achieved through economic progress. So economic progress and the physical comfort is the true part of mankind. That is the second idea. And happiness, what is happiness? Happiness is when this is achieved, when this progress of physical comfort for oneself is achieved and economic progress is achieved. Look at how the whole attention of the country is focused on GDP, growth, economic growth, progress. Anything and everything is sacrificed. Ecology, human relations, value systems, everything can be compromised if economic growth is achievable. So the human life as well as the whole of nature is commercialized. This is what happens with that one basic seed idea that human being is just a physical body. From that one idea arises this host of ideas, and this host of ideas gives rise to these innumerable conditions of exploitation and problems that we face today. That is that one seed idea. So somewhere in the Viveka Chudamani, Shankaracharya says that this idea of mistaken idea of self, that we are just this body, is sarvanartha karanam, which means that is the root cause of all anarthas. All disasters arise from that one basic root idea. So if this is the current idea that is promulgated in the education system as well as in among the masses as generally understood, what is the ancient idea? Let us try to understand that. The ancients said that man is not his body at all. Man is not his body at all, but he is a spiritual being. He is a spiritual entity. We think man is a material entity, matter, material. But man is actually a spiritual entity. He is not of the nature of matter. He is a spiritual being, which in turn means that there can be no beginning and no end to his existence. He is undying, eternal. And this is the primary idea which is taught by all true teachers when they come to teach us. You see, in any religion, probe deeper into it, we will find that the spiritual nature of man is at the root of all the teachings. And what does this mean? What does man being a spiritual entity mean? It means that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature. Because all beings are spiritual, all beings arise from spirit, spirit is one. So all beings arise from the one common source, which means brotherhood, universal brotherhood, is a fact in nature. It's not merely an ideal, it is a fundamental fact in nature. And what does it mean for two things to be connected, two things to be interrelated, two people to be said to be brothers? It means there is an obligation. There is a duty, natural duty. Because of the very fact of interconnectedness, there is a natural duty towards one another. Duty is not something that is imposed by a group of people or a government outside us, but it is innate in man. By the very fact of his existence and interconnectedness, duty is there, and that is his innate, it is innate in him. So if this duty is neglected, this duty which arises from our connection, indissoluble connection with all beings, if this is neglected, right, then they said that it gives rise to all problems, all kinds of problems. You know, in biological functions, a cell or a group of cells which behave this way, which way? That is, they work only for themselves, without any regard for its surroundings, with disregard towards its interconnectedness towards the other parts of the body. If a cell or a group of cells behave this way, it's called as cancer. Cancer is that a malignant growth which invades upon other cells and which works only for itself with disregard towards its duty towards the whole of the body. That's a cancer. So a being who behaves this way is a cancer in the society. It's a cancer. Our mind is cancerous if it is selfish, and if it disregards this basic unity of all beings. So after having said that man is a spiritual being, then he is interconnected, then there is duty which is imperative on him. They said that his body is merely an instrument which he keeps taking again and again till he reaches a point when he realizes thoroughly that he is inseparable from all. Till that end of the journey is reached, he keeps taking body again and again. Look at the modern view of man, which holds to what is the most impermanent aspect of man, the physical body, and makes it the be-all and end-all. And look at the ancient spiritual view of man, which makes man an eternal divine entity and clearly defines what is his relationship to the body and what is its significance. You know, we are discussing all these ideas because it has a practical view on our this subject, which is charity, practical charity. We'll see how it is important. So after having said that man is a spiritual being and all the ideas that we discussed, they said that there is an impulse in nature, there is an evolutionary law in nature, and this law works toward ensuring that all beings realize this fundamental oneness or unity. So this law is also in from other aspect, we can see that this is what the Buddhists and the Hindus called as the law of karma. The law of karma, an undeviating tendency in the universe which restores equilibrium. If a being acts selfishly, then the equilibrium is disturbed, and this law acts to restore the equilibrium. We find this expressed very beautifully in Light of Asia, a Buddhist text, and New Testament, and in various Hindu scriptures. Let's not go into the details of that, but it basically means, as a corollary of this law, that anything that we do, whether thinking, speaking or acting, the three modes of action, three channels of action, anything that we do has an effect on others, not only upon ourselves but on all others, and it will have a consequence upon us. That is the fundamental idea that must be remembered. So this is the comparison between what the modern idea is and the ancient idea of man and universe. Now, keeping this in mind, if we consider money, help through money, and charity, we find that there is a great danger in an emotional way and an emotional response towards a problem, and dangers of blind help which we sometimes render to others. It is said that it takes a very wise man to do good works without danger of doing incalculable harm. This is because we don't understand this law of evolutionary law of nature. If we understand evolutionary law and see that all beings, the conditions in which all beings are the results of their actions as well as the collective actions of others, and that gives some insight as to how to help a person, when to help a person, how and whom to help. It is said that it requires great knowledge and understanding of these laws of life to correctly help a person. Blindly helping a person because of emotional response as an emotional response many times has a harmful effect on them. Instead of helping, it harms them. So that is one thing. Next, we see that this idea of charity itself can be enlarged. Charity need not necessarily mean giving of money. Charity is primarily a mental attitude. It's a mental attitude. For example, let's consider condemnation of others. How many times we criticize others, condemn others, we may not express it verbally, but in our mind we judge others. That is non-charitable, uncharitable thought. So charity need not mean giving of money, and uncharity doesn't mean not giving of money, but it is there deep in our mind. It's a mental state. So let's consider this condemnation. When we criticize others, when we condemn others, do we know the complete person? Which means, in other words, do we know the entirety of his being? What we are seeing of a person, what we see of a person, is only a very small flash, a glimpse, that too an imperfect glimpse of the whole of his being that he is, he or she is. What we see in the present is only a small cross section. So do we judge a person based on this imperfect glimpse that we have of him? And secondly, when we judge or criticize or condemn, we are presuming that we ourselves are free from that defect. We are free from that defect. That's what our presumption is, which is absolutely wrong. So the first step in the path of aspiring towards wisdom is dana, defined as the key of charity and love immortal. Key of charity and love immortal. And next is also next idea that we can consider is revengefulness or not forgiving others. If we consider this idea, in that very idea we find there is violence in it. There is uncharitable, we find its uncharitable nature. See, you know, in one of the texts it is said that the duty of man is to drink without a murmur to the last drop, whatever contents the cup of life may have in store for us. So we complain and we feel we are unjustly offended, we feel somebody else hurt us, because we do not understand that all that is happening to us is a result of our own past actions. Nothing can happen to us which we have not been the cause of. So this again comes from dwelling upon and understanding of the law of karma, which is absolute justice. See, we must remember that there is this immutable law of life, which is justice. Anything that is happening to us, though an apparent harm may come from another, it is absolutely just. If we were not the cause of it, then the other person wouldn't be harming us. In some past life or in this life, knowingly or unknowingly, we must have set up that cause which has resulted in that other person harming us. The wise course of action is rendering good for evil. complete forgiveness and forgetfulness. The unwise course of action is to take revenge. Again, this is this is very relevant to our topic, which is practical charity. Charity need not do anything with money. It is how we deal with others. Practical charity deals with how we engage with others, how we treat others, how we respond to life. That is where charity comes, which means charitable attitude towards others. So which is why in the ancient scriptures we find that ahimsa along with satya are two highest virtues. Two greatest virtues are ahimsa and these both contain in itself all other virtues. All other virtues arise from ahimsa and satya. So what is the best help that we can do to others? What is the most practical way of being charitable? What is the best way to help better the conditions of the world? Best way is to change oneself. We cannot change things outside oneself, because what is there outside is a result of what is inside. The outer effects that we see, the conditions, good and bad, are the results of the good and bad that is inside man. Inside man, yes, inside us. So, how can we best help the world? It is not by, you know, renouncing our duties and responsibilities in which in the conditions in which we are placed, and going to some so-called third world country and helping them. That is not how we help the world. We help the world by doing each and every duty of ours in the station of life in which we are placed. Now, does this mean that we do away with all help that we can render to others? No, that is not what is meant. What is meant is two things. To actually help a person, you must have spiritual insight. Otherwise, you may be doing incalculable harm to him and to others. And secondly, that doesn't mean you give up actions, acts of kindness. Do it, but do it by acquiring spiritual wisdom, and through that light, do it. And the best help is, you know, transforming oneself by taking spiritual knowledge. Because if we ourselves are drowning in ignorance, how is it that we can help others? Let us not think that by just merely feeding the body we are helping others. The roots of these problems, health problems, problems of economic distress and so on and so forth, political, social conditions, all arise from moral character of man. So the best help that we can do is that which will elevate the thinking and the understanding of the human mind from the level in which it is in to a better stand. That we can do, the best help, as Buddha says, of all the gift of Dhamma is the highest. That gift of Dhamma we can bestow upon another when we ourselves have imbibed it within us. So taking knowledge is the very first step. It may appear very critical, it may appear very philosophical and dry for people to actually study and get to know this philosophy of life. They want something immediate to do, something that will satisfy their emotional nature, something that will, that can be concretely done. But again, let us remember that to actually help a person requires great spiritual insight. We may be harming the person without understanding the complexities of human nature, of psychological conditions, and without the knowledge of karma and reincarnation. So we may be doing harm. That is one thing. And to practically help a person, you first prepare yourself. You first transform yourself. And look at this. All these exploitation, poverty and injustice arises from mistaken notions. And when those mistaken notions are corrected, then naturally the person becomes charitable. One of the direct effects of a true spiritual insight, which comes from study of these ancient truths, a direct result of this is to make the person charitable, make the person responsible. You cannot solve it through legislations and outer systems, but by changing the mind and understanding of people. That comes through spiritual knowledge. So, friends, let's stop here. These are just a few points on the subject, and we can take up any questions or any points related to the subject. You know, the important point is how the ideas that we hold in our mind has profound impact on our behavior and our actions individually and collectively, and how the ideas that we hold in our minds brings about great social changes and conditions. Political, economic, social, all of these arises from the ideas that we hold in our mind. You know, in one of the Buddhist texts, Vipallasa Sutra, Buddha mentions that there are three levels of distortions that happen in a human being. The first level of distortion is deep in mind, which is Ditti Vipallasa. Vipallasa means distortion or perversion. Ditti Vipallasa is distortion of view. Your views of life are distorted. From that distortion of the views of, which means you don't have right perception, you don't have the right doctrine, Samyak Darshana. Without that, the next level of distortion comes, which is Chitta Vipallasa. That is, you begin to think in the wrong direction. You begin to apply your mind in the wrong direction. Spend your mental energies in wrong things. And from that comes the final, which is distortion of the senses, that is the physical, which is sanna vipallasa. That is, whatever we do, whatever we act, how we see, how we behave, all this gets distorted. So the deep in our mind is the ideas which have profound impact on the society. And in that, there, what is the idea that we hold? Prevalent idea is one of separateness, one of individualism, separateness. Each one is separate from all others. That is the root of the problem which gives rise to various conditions. And practical charity is when we do the correction deep inside our mind and understand that separateness is wrong, non-separateness is truth, unity is truth. When that arises, when the Ditti Vipallasa is removed, when the Ditti is corrected, then our Chitta is corrected. Chitta is corrected, we begin to act correctly. And then you need no external legislation and civil societies and philanthropic organizations doing work, because each being becomes a unit of tremendous beneficence to everybody around him. He gives more than what he takes, of his own accord, with the right motive, to the highest benefit of each being. That is why all teachers stress upon the importance of spiritual wisdom, spiritual knowledge as the first step. You cannot do outside works and solve human problems. Because the human problems are rooted deep in our moral nature. You know, in the text, The Dream of Ravan, read this portion, very nice, where sage Ananta is explaining to Ravan in this work. He is explaining one of the visions which Ravan had in his dream, and as a part of that he gives a philosophical discourse. He says this, I quote, O tragic man, whence is all this death in thy life? Alas, it is because an inward moral death reigns throughout all that it must have this outward manifestation also. Men's souls are dead when they are born. This life is the autopsy, and the disease is made manifest to all. One died mad of pride, one frenetic with anger, one leprous with sensuality, one fever of ambition, one suffered from the insatiable craving of greed, one from the malignant venom of revenge, one from the jaundice of jealousy, one from the eating cancer of envy, one from the surfeit of self-love, one from the paralysis of apathy. Many were the diseases, but death into this world, the common of all, the common result of all. Yes, death is triumphant here, death physical and moral. The dead bring forth the dead bear the dead to the funeral pyre, the dead walk about the streets and greet each other, and bargain and buy and sell and marry and build, and know not all the time that they are but ghosts and phantoms. That land of silence and shadows, of desolation and ruins, of sorrow and death, in which thy soul walked in the vision, O Titan, is the world in which thy dead body now walks waking. Renounce and annihilate it, O King, by asceticism and divine gnosis, and thus return to real life, unquote. Very, very nice, very beautiful, very poetic, very profound. And elsewhere Krishna says very clearly that it is better to perish in the performance of one's own duty, even though devoid of excellence, than to attempt the duty of another. The duty of another is full of danger. Let's stop here with a closing thought from one of the masters of wisdom, who says, he who does not practice altruism, he who is not prepared to share his last morsel with a weaker or poorer than himself, he who neglects to help his brother men of whatever race, nation or creed, whenever and wherever he meets suffering, and who turns a deaf ear to the cry of human misery, he who hears an innocent person slandered, whether a brother theosophist or not, and does not undertake his defense as he would undertake his own, is no theosophist.